Hi, and welcome to Walk Talk, a podcast courtesy of the Wound, Ostomy, and Continence Nurses Society. Walk Talk is your opportunity to learn more about advocacy, education, and research that support the practice and delivery of expert healthcare to individuals with wound, ostomy, and continence care needs. Please visit wocn.org/podcast to subscribe and make sure you never miss an episode. Now, here's your host, Jody Scardillo.
Welcome to this week's edition of Walk Talk. I'm your host, Jody Scardillo. This special podcast is part of the Ostomy Observation Series, a six-part series included in the Educating Today for Exceptional Outcomes Tomorrow program. During this episode, we sit down with Joanne Ermer-Seltoun to discuss ileostomy blockage. Both the Ostomy Observations podcast series and the Educating Today for Exceptional Outcomes Tomorrow program are commercially supported through an educational grant from Hollister Incorporated. For additional information, please visit wocn.org/exceptional outcomes. The WOCN Society does not endorse or support products or services. Thanks so much for joining me today, Joanne. I'm so happy to have you here.
It's great to be here, and it's a pleasure and honor to be asked as well. Thank you.
Yeah, this is a great topic. We're going to be talking about ileostomy blockage. And I always like to know about people's WOC experiences and what your current role is and about your practice. So will you start by telling us a little bit about that, Joanne?
A little bit about me. I'm going to go way back when. I graduated from the University of Iowa College of Nursing in 1984. I began my nursing career at the VA Medical Center in Phoenix, Arizona. That's where I fell in love with WOC, or we called it ET nursing back then. And I fell in love because I was watching this well-seasoned ET nurse, Mary Phillips, back in the 80s. And she provided this ostomy education to our general surgical inpatients. And I found ostomy care and providing this one-on-one education extremely fascinating and desirable. She kind of took me under her wing and mentored me. I joined her and the Rocky Mountain Region conferences and local ET meetings. And I just want to do a big shout out to the Rocky Mountain Region WOC nurses, because that's part of my alma mater. I was the last class to graduate from ET school at Tucson Medical Center in 1989. And I was in my mid-20s. I had two toddlers at home. And let me tell you, God bless my husband, Les. And I had another one on the way. So I feel for some of our learners at our nursing education program that have young children. It's challenging. So we decided to head back to Iowa, where I was born and raised. And I obtained a position as a WOC nurse for a home care agency in Mason City, Iowa. And that lasted from about 1990 to 98. And there was two of us, two WC nurses, and our group quickly grew to five WC nurses. And we developed contracts with surrounding rural hospitals, public health agencies, long-term care, and outpatient clinics. And then finally, in 1999, I graduated as a family nurse practitioner to enhance my autonomy as a WC nurse, just like many of you all have done. I switched from home care consultant to an outpatient wound ostomy continence clinic, and I'm still there providing holistic care to people in the need of wound ostomy and continence care, but it's just 2 days a week. In addition, in 2002, I was invited to join the faculty of Web Walk Nursing Education Program, mostly due to my passion in continence specialty nursing. So frequently, I'm known for that as being the pessary queen. So they needed someone with that continence specialty. And then in 2011, I became a co-director of Web Walk along with Deborah Nietzsche, and then a president of Web Walk programs back in 2021. And there I work 3 days a week. So if you're wondering, what am I doing on those other days? That's what I'm doing. So in a nutshell, WC nurse through and through for the last 34 years. And I certainly believe all this has occurred through, I'm going to say, divine appointment and several angels, or I call mentors, throughout my career. And I bet a lot of you have them as well. I'm just one of many testaments that the WOC nursing specialty provides what I call an incredible window of opportunity. And some people have heard me say that before, a woohoo or window of opportunity for professional growth and development. And that little saying came from a motivational speaker that I just love, was Brian Biro. And he always talked about the woos in life, windows of opportunities.
Okay. I like that. So you have like the best of both worlds, sort of. You have the clinical patient client relationships, and then you have education. So you have impact in big ways that way too.
Absolutely. I think it is the best of both worlds, and there's never a dull moment.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's great. Good for you. And so now we have to get onto the topic at hand, which is ileostomy blockages. And so I think this is a topic we don't really talk about that much. So I'm excited to learn from you and hear what you have to say about this. And so I probably should start by just talking about what is an ileostomy blockage.
Well, we know if the small bowel is functioning normally, it digests products and it will continue to flow onward and exit the ileostomy stoma. So an obstruction in the small bowel can be partly or completely blocked, jammed, hindered, this intestinal waste products. Some people use the words effluent, stool, poo, feces, dung, scat, number two, you know, but there's a blockage of that from passing through the stoma. This causes waste matter and gases to build up in the portion behind the blockage. Kind of think of a dam or a clogged drain. You get nasty backup for sure.
And so why is this important for us to talk about and probably patients to know about?
I think this topic is of utmost importance, you know, especially for the ostomy nurse specialists who can provide, I call anticipatory guidance on the signs, symptoms of partial or complete small bowel obstruction. What to do if they experience those symptoms, and best of all, risk reduction tactics to possibly prevent it from ever occurring. Plus, small bowel obstruction can lead to death, especially if the blood supply to the intestine is compromised. So if you know anyone who's been hospitalized for small bowel obstruction, it's awful. They'll tell you that. They call in the Roto-Rooter team, so to speak. They place a nasal gastric tube, essentially a sump pump, down the nose to extract that sewer back up. I mean, really, if the blockage is severe, that patient could even spew out septic tank contents. Y'all know, can envision what I'm saying here. Patients will often tell you that was the worst part of their hospitalization experience. And that's so funny that I'm speaking about this because I had a patient just this week who shared that exact sentiment. He said, the NG tube was by far the worst part of his small bowel obstruction experience.
Wow. That's kind of scary.
It is, for sure.
Okay. And then you mentioned partial or complete. And so differences besides one is completely blocked and the other isn't. I bet there's some other differences you should tell us about.
Yeah. Let's go with partial first. So if it's partial, it means think of a dam, but it still has the spillway open. There's some watery waste that are exiting the stoma. But in a complete blockage, this kind of represents a dam closure. So that spillway is closed. So nothing's going to exit this dammed up ileostomy stoma, so to speak.
Okay. And are there differences in the symptoms, Joanne, do your patients tell you?
Yeah. I'll start with partial blockage symptoms. They can range from abdominal distension, bloating, crampy pain. They'll see maybe their stoma swells. They'll have watery, stinky output. They might feel pressure at the stoma with the stool coming out in little spurts. You might even be thinking, well, why do those symptoms happen? So being an educator, I'm going to kind of fill you in on the pathophysiology of that. So the small bowel obstruction, this partial one, leads to dilation of that proximal intestine due to accumulations of GI secretions and all your swallowed air. So this bowel dilation, what it does, it stimulates intestinal cell secretory activity. Now, this results in more fluid accumulation. So the abdomen expands as the intestine dilates. And one thing we might find interesting is our small bowel normally is less than an inch in diameter. So if it's swelling, that diameter narrows the lumen even more. So when the bowel tries to squeeze or push the feces forward, past that obstruction, it causes cramping and discomfort. So patients will complain of maybe a queasy, nauseating sensation. And as you can imagine, this might result in reduced appetite. And they'll start limiting fluid intake, leading to what? Reduced urine production. They might see their urine turn darker in color and We all know that represents signs of dehydration. But in a complete small bowel obstruction, situation you have are the same symptoms I just talked about, but they're intensified. So more bloating, more abdominal distension, severe cramping, stoma edema, and plus no stool output from the stoma. Nothing. Zero, zilch, nil, number two. It's kind of the qualifier for that complete blockage. And then regrettably, vomiting or spewing the septic tank-like contents may occur at this stage where it's complete.
Wow.
Yuck. Yuck.
Yuck is right. And what are the most common causes of both partial and complete blockages, would you say?
So causes can range from mechanical factors. And when I mean that, I mean structural barriers or functional issues, meaning lack of the intestinal peristalsis. And we all know that as ileus. So interesting about the literature, it reports the top three causes of small bowel obstruction are one is adhesion. So that's number one, bands of scar tissue causing these strictures. And they are more prone if they have a history of prior abdominal surgery. So that develops more adhesions. The second most common cause is hernias. Segments of the intestine might break through a weakened section of the abdominal wall. We all know it creates a bulge where the bowel can become obstructed if it's trapped or tightly pinched in place where it pokes through the abdominal wall. I was doing some fact finding as I was preparing for this podcast, and it says that up to 48% of people with ostomies develop a hernia. So some of the literature, and it's pretty high. And then the third cause for small bowel obstruction was malignancy. There's some easy mnemonic. If you want to remember the top three causes, it's just an ABC mnemonic. A stands for adhesions, B stands for bulge or the hernia, and then C stands for cancer. I would say that these three mechanical causes account for about 80% of all the causes of small bowel obstruction. There's some other causes. It's inflammatory issues that cause strictures or adhesions. So think about your patients who have inflammatory bowel disease or someone who's had severe diverticulitis. All that inflammation makes them have those adhesions and strictures. A less common cause would be intussusception, where the intestine telescopes into itself. Volvulus is also a twisting of the colon. And then there's some other things like gallstone formed bodies. But another one I think that is kind of appropriate for our discussion today, since we're talking about ileostomies, are bezoars. Maybe you haven't heard that term before, but what that is tightly packed mass of undigested or partially digested material, which could be food. Some people eat funny things. They say particles of plastic or medications that accumulate, but vegetable fibers, things that are like, you know, your insoluble fibers. So I'll be talking a little bit more about that, bezoars. And then there's some other unusual things like trauma and iatrogenic type problems. But I would say poorly digested food is the main reason for people with an ileostomy to develop a partial or complete small bowel obstruction. When I see them, you know, in my outpatient clinic type of thing, especially add some of those other additional risk factors like a peristomal hernia or a history of multiple abdominal surgeries, that really can increase their risk.
Do you have any idea of like how prevalent the blockages are? Like with so many causes, it's kind of hard to know how common is that exactly?
Yeah, I had to do a little research on that when you asked that question, but quite prevalent. Maybe all of you think, yeah, I agree with that. One of my reputable sources, I was up to date. They were saying that small bowel obstruction is a common disease and it accounts for 12 to 16% of surgical admissions and more than 300,000 operations annually in the United States. And here's a big one, approximately 30,000 deaths in the United States.
Wow. Wow.
But also, in contrast, they're saying another interesting fact is that 60 to 85% of the adhesion rated small bowel obstructions, they resolve without surgery. So that's good news. It's costly for healthcare systems, and they estimated over $1 billion annually for small bowel obstruction.
Wow. That's a lot of money. Wow.
It is. I had a 2023 journal article too. It talked about small bowel obstruction because I was looking really more specifically how often it happens in our patients with an ileostomy specifically. And so this was more recent from a surgical journal. And they said for ileostomies, it occurs in the early postoperative period after colorectal surgery. So I'm thinking about that 0 to 30 days, and its incidence significantly increases to 23% when they have a diverting loop ileostomy. Think of your low anterior resection patients who might have that. I don't know about in your area, but what I see in North Iowa is that some of our surgeons are actually doing a diverting loop ileostomy for people with perforated diverticulitis instead of doing the end colostomy and a Hartmann's pouch. So they are the ones that are at higher risk for getting a early on small bowel obstruction because of the edema. I'm taking it. It is. So.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So to me, this makes a huge point for anyone that's in acute care is to talk to their patients with those diverting loop ileostomies about the high risk of them having readmissions right at the get-go for developing a small bowel obstruction. And again, this is just very interesting is that I had a patient within the last month tell me, he comes to my outpatient clinic, so I'm doing a post-op check a month out from his discharge from the hospital. And he says after he went home, he was readmitted less than 2 days because of his diverting loop ileostomy, had the small bowel obstruction. And all they could come up with was it was from intestinal swelling.
Wow. Okay. I sometimes find in my practice that I'll have patients anecdotally just say to me in conversation, yeah, a few weeks ago, I had some symptoms, like I was nauseous and my ostomy wasn't working and I had eaten whatever, some high fibrous thing. And I took a hot shower and it sort of resolved. And then I was thinking to myself, I wonder if a lot of these episodes are really not reported because the patient manages themselves. Is that your experience too? Like that maybe these are underreported?
Yep. I agree with what you just said. I think that people with partial small bowel obstruction, they'll tell me throughout the years that they get plugged up and they know why. They can tell you exactly. And I have another example. It's funny that these things just happened within the month or this week here. I had a gentleman with longtime ileostomy from inflammatory bowel disease. He shared with me his little home remedies that he helped unblock him after his binging on nuts. He loves nuts. And he says, I can feel it. I feel this bag of gravel right next to my stoma. Then he says, I just drink lots of fluids and I massage my belly and I lean to the right because that's where his stomacite is. And he says it relaxes and he can just feel this bag of gravel pass on through. And so, as we all know, luck always ends at some point because I was seeing him in my outpatient clinic 2 weeks post-discharge from the hospital for a small bowel obstruction. He attributes his home remedy failure to the development of his hernia, his peristomal hernia, which we know is another risk factor, and it became incarcerated. He had pictures of this in the OR. He lost 5 inches more of his ileum due to the ischemia or the lack of the blood flow to his intestine. And what's funny is that this guy had an amazingly positive attitude. He still felt lucky because he got a new stoma on the left side and his hernia was repaired. So I had to really talk him out of not eating all those nuts.
Yeah, hopefully he won't do that again, right?
Well, you hope.
Right. So that brings up a good question. So what do you teach patients about this? Because I think a lot of us in clinical practice probably have a lot of opportunities for education for patients around this whole topic, especially this kind of, quote, food blockage or nut blockage in your patient's case.
Right, right. Well, this is going to come from more of an outpatient perspective because that's where I'm at. So I say, be sure the individual understands their type of ostomy surgery and stoma and why they have it. You think that that seems to be a duh, Joanne, but really a lot of patients don't understand really what they have. They don't know if they have a colostomy, ileostomy, and why they have it. I'll do lots of discussion about foods to avoid, which I'll discuss later in our talk here. I really key in on the signs and symptoms of partial or complete intestinal blockage, and then to follow more of a stepwise approach to manage those symptoms. And that information I give them is really outlined well in our WOCN core curriculum, second edition ostomy management. In fact, it's chapter 14, or think of the United Ostomy Association of America's handout on how to treat ileostomy blockage. And just by the way, side point, it's so exceptionally done. I throw out all my other handouts because it's so beautiful. It's colorful. It's easy to understand. It's got great organization of content. I think I'm really focused on that because my husband's a graphic designer, so he was impressed on the look of that educational material. Mm-hmm.
It does attract the eye, doesn't it? It makes you sort of want to read the information. It's so appealing.
Yeah, right. And then I also focus, Jody, on notifying when to notify their primary care provider or the ostomy nurse specialist, or when to go to the emergency room as well.
Okay. So what are the initial measures that most people with a food blockage, or like a partial blockage, would take? What are you recommending generally?
I'm going to outline it just kind of like how the UOAA says, you know, it's that stepwise. Step one, if you got partial blocky symptoms, meaning you're not vomiting, you still got some stool, monitor your stoma, first of all. If it starts to swell, make sure they're replacing their pouching system. They need that ostomy skin barrier opening a little larger than the normal to accommodate that swelling. If there isn't any output from the stoma, but they're not nauseated, they're not vomiting, stop eating solid food and only consume liquids such as some juices, warm broth, or tea. They can take a warm bath or shower to relax their abdominal muscles. They can try different body positions, just like I mentioned about my gentleman who does. He always leaned to the side of her stoma. You can do a knee chest position. Those all might help move that blockage forward. Massaging abdomen, just like I mentioned he did. He massaged around his stoma, his abdominal area. And what we know is that most of those food blockages or bezoars occur just below the stoma, right at the fascial level. And that might all help dislodge that blockage there. Another thing, exercise. Walk slowly in the house or move with the groove as long if it's not too painful. We know that exercise improves our blood flow and also peristalsis. And then some of the educational guides that I've looked at talk about using a heating pad and place on a low setting. But, you know, I work in a wound center and I've seen too many full thickness burns from heating pads. So I personally, this is just for me, do not advocate this measure. It's just too much room for error in my book. So I don't recommend heating pads.
Okay. So more of the shower for
yeah.
you. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I go on for the second step for the person who's got more of those complete blockage symptoms. They don't have any output, maybe for several hours. They have horrible abdominal pain, or they're vomiting. Their abdomen's so swollen, distended. Color of the stoma might even be darkened. This is when you're telling them, don't eat, don't drink anything. That's a 911 call, meaning call your doctor, or in my book, go to the emergency room immediately. Tell them to take their pouching supplies to the ER because they may not have your particular products. And I can guarantee you they most likely will not. And then I'll just call everyone's attention again to that UOAA, this excellent guide for ER medical personnel, how to treat ileostomy food blockages. So they just give them this handout there. And this is also covered really well in our WOCN core curriculum in the appendix and on what emergency personnel should know about ileostomy and potential for food blockage. I think it's great information.
That's great. And does that include irrigation? Like I remember learning in when I was ET school too about ileostomy lavage or irrigation. Do some of those recommendations still include that, Joanne?
Yeah. In fact, both of those resources I told you kind of outline to the medical personnel what to do and then who should do the ileo lavage and kind of goes through the procedure of it, actually.
Okay. Okay. So if you don't do it except every 10 years or something, then you have right. some reference to look it up, right? And when patients go to the ED, do they get imaging or do people like digitalize the stoma to see if they can feel anything in it? Or what's your experience been, or what do patients tell you about that?
Yeah. So I always say if they're going to the emergency room and it's looking like a small bowel blockage, you know, you have to know why. I gave you all those reasons why people have small bowel blockages, and food can be just one of them. Usually you have a pretty good hint if the patient kind of tells you, I ate something I wasn't supposed to. So I always say do a thorough focused abdominal stoma assessment first. Diagnostics are helpful to determine if the cause of the small bowel obstruction is unclear or if indeed that's the problem. So follow doing a digital exam of the stoma. It's either done by the provider or maybe sometimes done by the ostomy nurse. And they can confirm if the small bowel obstruction is a form of a bezoar or undigested food. Why not save that patient some money and try ileostomy lavage? That's got to be per order, of course, first to see if it relieves the food blockage. If you palpated upon your digital exam, you palpated that blockage right at the stoma there.
And do you have any tips for doing that lavage? Like as far as getting the fluid in, you know how when you do an ostomy irrigation of a stoma, sometimes the patient has to like do some maneuvers to get the solution to flow well. Does that go on with the ileostomy lavage too?
What they say in the both for the actual procedure of the lavage there is, again, gently insert a lubricated glove finger into the lumen of the stoma. And if you can palpate the blockage, then you're going to try to break it up a bit with your finger. That is going to cause some cramping. We expect that with the patient there. If you happen to have a colostomy irrigation set sleeve and patients wearing a two-piece system, you could snap that on there. That's one recommendation. If they're not wearing a two-piece pouch, you can take that irrigation sleeve with an elastic belt and place it over the stoma. Or if you have none of those things, you can actually just cut a hole in their pouching system and use that as your collection there. You can work through the pouch opening and then you'll insert a soft lubricated catheter around 14 to 16 French into the lumen of the stoma until the blockage is reached. They tell you never, ever, ever force the catheter. So if you're meeting resistance, you're not going to keep pushing through. Same thing too with instilling the fluid. Slowly instill it, 30 to 50 milliliters of normal saline in the catheter using a bulb syringe. You don't want to put a lot of pressure behind that, you know, like squeeze hard. It's supposed to be gentle. So once you instill, if you're able to instill, remove the catheter and kind of let the returns go into the irrigation sleeve. And it's kind of a tedious process. You just keep repeating the procedure of instilling 30 to 50 milliliters at a time until the blockage is resolved. And they report that sometimes it takes up to 1 to 2 hours to really get that food blockage dislodged. If it's unsuccessful, of course, then the surgeon's going to be notified for sure on that because we've got to look further. Something else has got to be done.
Right. And is your experience that once that blockage is released, then the patient just pours out fluid? That's been what I've found. Like they'll have no or very little output, and then whatever it is loosened up and resolved.
I'm going to go back to my analogy. If a dam breaks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All that backup is got to go through and get out. And so you've got all those extra fluids too from the intestinal lumen. It's got so much fluid in there. So you're going to have lots and lots more fluids. They're going to have a lot more high output for sure.
Okay. All right. And besides nuts, what else food-wise do you find that people might be predisposed to have a food blockage? I know raisin bran. I had a patient eat like a lot of raisin bran one day and that didn't go well. But what other things generally are in your experience do you find give people more trouble in terms of that?
Mostly it's foods that have a large amount of insoluble fiber. So these are the foods that don't gel up when they're mixed with fluids. So essentially, they're keeping their original form. So what you see going into your mouth is what you're going to see coming out the other end. In this case, it would be the stoma. So common small bowel offenders, I would say, would be like your veggies, especially the Chinese ones, you know, bamboo shoots, bok choy, cabbage, even cooked cabbage is problematic, coleslaw, celery. You put a celery in a glass of water, what does it happen? Nothing happens to it, just stays celery. So same thing with whole kernel corn and mushrooms of all types, fresh broccoli, fresh cauliflower are culprits. So if you cook those things really well, you can take those. Those are okay. Pineapple, fresh raw pineapple can be very problematic. It's got a lot of insoluble fiber. Anything with the skin on your fresh fruits, like think of your apple peels, grapes, other things are like dried fruits, raisins, dried mangoes, dried cherries, coconut, nuts, seeds, and popcorn. And I'm going to say maybe the last three items that I just mentioned, which what it was, nuts, seeds, and popcorn. I think it's challenging for many of us to omit them from our diet. So I can see why people are challenged.
Yeah. Especially if they eat a lot at one time. Like Absolutely. Sometimes people do better with a little bit of whatever that is, but a lot of it all at once seems to be a problem.
You're going to get a chuckle out of this. So I was in our clinic Wednesday. And again, I just happened to have that follow-up with that patient with the ileostomy I told you about that lost 5 inches. And he had a hernia and he had everything moved to the other side. Before he came, and he's saying this with a smile on his face, he says, I ate a whole bag of pistachio nuts before coming to my clinic visit. And yep. I took his pouch off and guess what? We had a whole bunch of chunks of pistachio nuts evacuated from his stomach. And I'm like, no, I just wanted to plug in my ears. But what's interesting about that visit is that we spent a long time discussing his risky choice and his whole experience that just happened while he was in the hospital and how he hated that NG tube. And I pulled out those UOAA handouts again. And for some reason, this time it stuck.
Good.
He took the handouts because he had his ileostomy a long time. So he knew everything. But this time he took the information. So be tenacious, I guess.
Right. Persistence is key yes. in our role, I think,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Right. And so it seems like a lot of patients manage these partial food blockages at home from what you're saying, or we think a lot of that happens. And so what do you recommend once the blockage is resolved and the ostomy is working? What do you tell people about diet after that? Because things have to be aggravated inside from all of this. So what do you think about that?
So I think with patients with ileostomies, you know, they know when they have pushed the envelope. They're binge watching TV shows like Duck Dynasty, Hallmark Holiday Series, or Yellowstone, and they're mindlessly eating that whole bag of popcorn or nuts without much fluids. So again, patients share their partial small bowel obstruction stories and what they do. And to me, that's just like playing a Russian roulette. So once the blockage is resolved, what I suggest is, especially if they have stoma edema, a low fiber, low residue diet until that stoma edema has resolved, then also to be sure to be drinking 8 to 10 cups of fluids per day. And people are challenged with that. That is very difficult to do. You might be saying, well, what do I mean by low fiber, low residue? I mean, after any of our ostomy surgeries, especially ileostomy, most surgeons recommend a 4 to 6 week low fiber, low residue diet. So that would be more of your lean proteins, meats, fish, poultry, low fat dairy products, eggs. You can do smooth peanut butters, almond butter, low fiber breads would be like your white breads or crackers, your cooked cereals, white rice, white pasta is fine. Veggies, boy, they got to be really, really cooked till they're very tender. You can even mash them, boil them, or puree them there to follow more of a low fiber, low residue diet. Your fruits, again, too, think of cooked canned fruits, really soft, applesauce, bananas, and then desserts, maybe custard sherbets or popsicles, clear jellies would be okay. But all those things that we just talked about, more insoluble fiber, they got to stay away from that. So you can say yes or no, but I have a little ditty for you if it's okay to share.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course, I'm going to say yes.
Just thinking, because I always tell patients chew their food and drink, drink, drink. So I thought, oh, chew your food so it goes down the stream. Merrily, 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 abdominal cramps gone away. Drink, drink, drink your fluids, liquefying number two. Merrily, 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 a perfect poo is the dream. There you go.
You have another career option ahead of you, Joanne. That's awesome.
Ditty making.
Yeah, but I bet people remember that, right?
There you go.
Yeah. What do you think about that chewing? I think people don't chew well enough in general. And so I really think that's a struggle for some new ostomy patients, especially ileostomy, when they really have to be aware of their fluid intake and their foods they're eating and the chewing. What do you think about that?
I think all of us do. I think as Americans, we are in a hurry. And I mean, if you travel anywhere else, the dinner time, meal time is family time, and they spend 1 to 2 hours at the table eating. We're about 10 minutes at the table and we're done. So I agree with you. You have to be intentional about it. And your patients with ileostomies, very much so. You just have to keep reminding them chewing and chewing and chewing and chewing in small bits and then drinking in between mouthfuls, even to help things go through.
And just to quickly go back, I had another thought. So on that person that you gave all those suggestions after the blockage is resolved, say they feel fine, but you don't have them stay on liquids for any time. It's just resume that low fiber diet, right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. As long as they're not nauseated, they're not having cramping and things like that, we just need to go back into slowly. I think one question was, is how long a stoma might stay edematous after the episode? And I think that's probably very individualized, depending on the severity of the small bowel obstruction and if it resolves on its own versus someone who had surgery. So, which we do know that most of them resolve without surgery. So just for them to be more aware to cut the ostomy skin barrier opening to match their stoma and size it maybe each week. And if they see no size changes maybe after 2 weeks, then they know that their stoma is back down to its usual size. And that might be an indication they can maybe slowly introduce a higher fiber diet with that. So that's just me thinking of that. But we certainly know if our patients had surgery and let's say revised stoma, we're going to recommend 4 to 6 weeks probably of that low fiber, low residue diet because it takes a while for that stoma to reduce in size. They say what, 4 to 8 weeks for some patients for that. So same directions, just making sure that your ostomy skin barrier opening matches the stoma shape and size.
I often wonder if it was difficult for the blockage to resolve. Like, say you had to lavage it and say it was a little bit of production more than a hot shower, if that seems to make the stoma stay more edematous longer. Do you have any thoughts about that? Like, it just seems like the more difficult it was to resolve the issue, the more swollen the stoma might be for a longer time. What do you think about that?
I agree with you. What can I say about that? It's mostly watching their ostomy skin barrier. Just with a sidebar conversation, reducing that stoma swelling, I think that if we could reduce it, it might help that food blockage pass along if it's due to a food blockage. This is just anecdotal. This is me thinking out loud. If the stoma is swollen, if we can use cold compresses, like taking a towel with some ice and put it on the stoma, we can maybe reduce some of that edema. If we reduce luminal diameter, maybe that food blockage would go through faster. I don't know. Or we could use an osmotic agent such as sugar or honey. But we know that with prolapses, they get really, really swollen, that we tend to do that. So maybe that would be helpful. But if you're doing the cold therapy, it's with a pouch on, no more than 5 minutes at a time. If they use sugar, they're talking about using just a plain old household sugar to the stoma. They can leave it on 20 to 30 minutes, and that can reduce the amount of swelling there. This might be something that somebody could do at home. It gets messy, especially if they have a lot of fluid. They're going to make a lot of liquid mucoidy type discharge in the pouch if they use the sugar there. But I don't know about hot showers. I just never say the word hot. I'll say a very warm bath or shower just to help them relax. And along with the abdominal massaging we mentioned, but patients want to listen to their ostomy nurses. So if you tell them a hot shower, it's going to be hot. And I don't want anybody to end up with scalded skin because I told them hot.
Yeah, that's very good advice, Joanne. I never would have thought of that that way. Sometimes people are very literal with what we tell them, right?
They are. You said, or I've heard this, drink a lot of fluids. I'm going to my continence clinic and they're drinking 15 to 20 cups of fluid.
Yeah. Coffee, right? Yeah, right. So you mentioned earlier on about the UOAA two-page document on managing food blockage. Are there other resources beyond that one that you like? You mentioned the core curriculum for nurses to get information about management of this. Anything else that you like or that you use in your practice around this area?
I do. I believe in working smarter and not harder. And a lot of people have worked hard in putting together some educational resources. And one of which that I'm sure all of you are familiar with is our manufacturers of our ostomy products. They all have outstanding online or hard copy educational materials, touching upon even today's topics, plus so much more. So I think we all develop our favorite resources. The key thing is to have those resources readily available because I think we're short on time, lots of times to put those together. And if you're not prepared, maybe your patient's going to miss out on some actual education pieces. It's hard for them to remember everything you say. We all know that they're going to remember maybe 10% and maybe even less than that if you happen to be discharging from the hospital because you're pretty blurry at that moment in time.
Yeah, it's a lot. I think all of the stuff we just tell people, then they have to remember it all and do it. Like not only do they have to remember, but then they have to do whatever it is we're trying to get them to do. So I do think it's a lot for our patients, a lot, all of this really. All right. What else is important that I haven't asked you? You gave us some really good strategies to identify and to manage the blockage situation. Anything else that we should talk about related to this, Joanne? You really gave us tons of good info to work with.
I think you had asked maybe if I had some tips for successful irrigation based on my experience. And to be honest, mine is more of that book knowledge. So I'm really going to point our ostomy nurse specialist to the WOC and ostomy management. That Appendix N gives you those steps, especially if they're unfamiliar with that. And then just giving your patients that UOA instructions, because attached to that is the information for them to give to the medical personnel in the ED. And then also, what about if the fluid doesn't go in or return? The guidelines really state never force the catheter, never use excessive pressure force fluid into the stoma if resistance known. Call the surgeon and let them be the ones that do that. And then maybe as a educator and being a longtime clinician, I have some ending thoughts is, you know, that I mentioned time is of essence and very, very limited. It's a precious commodity. So I do think we have to plan ahead and empower our patients by giving these educational resources that are evidence-based. People are gathering all kinds of things off the internet. They're looking at YouTube. They're looking at everybody else, maybe who has an ostomy that it's giving them maybe not evidence-based information. So I like to be proactive and not reactive, and I hate putting out fires. So I'm sure the rest of you would prevent a flame by starting everything out right. So use pre-printed handouts or your manufacturer's education booklets. And, you know, and if storage is an issue for you for those, then at least develop an online educational folder where you can easily print off your quality ostomy handouts and lots of different topics. And the other thing is, I know when someone's in acute care, the nurses, it's so hard because they're limited on the time. But if you can take the handouts and just go over key points of interest that's more individualized. For instance, the example I gave you of my patient who just came in and ate a bag of pistachio nuts, I'm going to key my focus on obstructive type foods because do you really want to go through this again? You know, so I'd like to encourage the ostomy nurse specialist to be just more intentional and prescriptive in providing their anticipatory guidance, especially to those high-risk patients who have that ileostomy, just to prevent small bowel obstruction from occurring and what to do if they have symptoms. That's it, pretty much.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I learned a lot today, and I really appreciate your time and doing this for us.
It was a pleasure, and it was fun to do this with you too, Jody. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Walk Talk. Please visit WOCN.org/podcast for additional details about this topic and the speakers. You can also get more information about subscribing to this podcast so you never miss an episode, and to get the latest news and information from the WOCN Society. Again, that's WOCN.org/podcast. We look forward to having you join us for the next episode of Walk Talk.